Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
I believe she was in Homecraft Court. Stand by.
Stop resisting!
The use of force by police in encounters with African Americans and Native Americans has gone front and center nationwide. How do Duluth and Superior measure up? We'll look at the data. Plus, you might recognize Lake Superior in their music.
I went down to the shoreline.
But is Great Lakes Country really a thing? We'll hear from Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. Those stories in the regional news and review after this.
Felt the breeze and caught the light. Turning star.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Homecraft Court, stand by.
Stop resisting!
The use of force by police in encounters with African Americans and Native Americans has gone front and center nationwide. How do Duluth and Superior measure up? We'll look at the data. Plus, you might recognize Lake Superior in their music.
I went down to the shoreline.
But is Great Lakes Country really a thing? We'll hear from Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. In little more than a week, the trial of the Minneapolis police officers accused of committing and abetting the murder of George Floyd begins in that city, and the whole world is watching. The death caught on camera last year of the unarmed black man sparked the racial reckoning, also worldwide, and spotlighted attention on the use of force by police in encounters with black people and other racial minorities. Yet is a disparity in how force is used and to whom true of all police departments, and of most concern to us locally, what's the story in our region? A grassroots data analysis group has requested that information from both the Duluth and Superior Police Departments, and both have supplied it. Here to present it and offer their interpretations on what it means are Jamie Sharp of the Law Enforcement Accountability Network, or LEAN, and Superior Chief of Police Nick Alexander. Welcome to Simply Superior, Jamie and Nick.
Welcome, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And I'll begin by saying Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan was invited to appear, and he also accepted, but he couldn't do so for this program, so he'll be here on a future show. So, Jamie, perhaps you can start by giving us the raw data from Duluth, which we'll analyze when Chief Tuscan can join us, and then the numbers for Superior, which you and Chief Alexander can dissect and interpret right here.
Thanks, Robin. I'll go ahead and start with those Duluth statistics. We received a lot of raw data from the Duluth Police Department, including the arrest rates from 2017 to 2020 and the use of force rates in 2019 stratified by race. The Duluth Police Department was very easy to work with and got us that data within a week of requesting it. Anyway, in 2019, there were 158 use of force incidents total in Duluth, and in those use of force incidents, there were 188 individuals involved. The department there defines force as the application of physical techniques or tactics, chemical agents, or weapons to another person. And the data, after we analyzed it, we found that per capita, Africans, Americans experience force at a rate more than 19 times that of whites, while Native Americans experience force at a rate more than 10 times that of whites. So pretty horrific data as far as when you compare it to the Duluth racial demographics.
So I will repeat the essence of that because numbers are hard to digest on the radio. For 2019, per capita, African Americans experienced force more than 19 times that of whites, while Native Americans experienced the use of force more than 10 times that of whites, and there were 158 incidents total. The numbers for Superior?
Yeah, so this is data that we received just this week, and in particular, of the use of force data that they have collected, and they haven't been collecting it for very long, there were 48 total use of force incidents. And of those, 70% of them were white, 13.3% were black, and 16.7% were native. And if you go ahead and run that analysis, we end up finding that native folks experience force at a rate 14.8 times greater than white people, and black folks 8.9 times greater. And that's when you're just looking at the overall population of Superior, which is 90.3% white, 1.7% black, and 1.4% native. It's a fairly small sample size, 48 total incidents. However, as you see, the disproportionality is quite large. We're talking, you know, 14 times more likely or 8 times more likely for Native and Black folks compared to white folks when experiencing force from the Superior Department.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to point out the small numbers. Are they statistically valid, or, you know, can you make judgments from those?
Yeah, personally, like, I think that all statistics tell a story, and it becomes a lot more complicated to directly focus on causation versus just correlation. I think that this sample size is too small to specifically say, you know, hey, this is all because of, you know, let's say racial profiling or racial bias amongst officers. Of course, you can't say this from this data. However, from my perspective, it's remarkably similar to what we're seeing in Duluth, which is a larger sample size, and remarkably similar to what we're seeing in larger cities, which is a much larger sample size. And I think that right now, at least the discussion that we're seeing on the national platform is, hey, like, perhaps this does have to do with some sort of racial bias or some sort of systemic racism that lies within the foundation of policing.
All right, so again, to repeat the essence, African Americans were 8.9 times more likely than whites to experience the use of force, while Native Americans were 14.8 times more likely than whites to experience use of force. Chief Alexander, what's your take?
Sure, just a brief correction. We have been collecting use of force data my entire career here. It's something that the state requires. The one difference is that we moved to a more comprehensive digital way of collecting the data, and that was the most easily accessible. So I can provide that, and it does give at least a few, you know, more years of overall use of force data. What I can summarize for you right now is that I'm looking at a screen of it from 2002 to 2017, and I see a high of of 50 use of force incidents in a year. That was 2003. The low is around 10 in 2011. And our historical average with the data that I have available to me right now is about 29 use of force incidents per year. Since I've been chief, we have made some progress on that, and the numbers have slowly gone down from 2015 through current. I believe right now our average for the last few years is about 22 use of force incidents per year. So, you know, not a huge reduction, but definitely trending in the direction that we want to see. I do think it has a lot to do with some changes in our training protocols. In the recent last 5 years, we've moved to more scenario-based training where we expose officers to as real-life or realistic scenarios that we can to give them experience in dealing with situations that way instead of just, you know, verbally providing a scenario or simply going to the range and training firearms. The goal of most of our training is to de-escalate and to reduce the need for use of force, and, you know, I do think that we're at least seeing some results from that. During this period of time, too, we've also implemented body-worn cameras for the entire department. We've invested in crisis intervention training, which gives officers some greater tools in terms of recognition and ways of de-escalation for people who are in mental health crises. And we've done a significant battery of trainings on implicit bias and fair and impartial policing.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed, and if I can interject here, in the report that Captain Winterschmidt gave to Jamie, he noted there were 51,500 official police incidents, out of which that 48 had use of force. So that pretty much tells me that if I call the police, I think he has at a 0.0009% of police contacts. Yeah.
I do believe that that's one way to look at it. I think I think probably a better way to look at it is in terms of arrest data, because, you know, a majority of our police calls, if there's 51,000 calls, a lot of them are, you know, contacts with the public that just result in a conversation, or it could be somebody reporting damage to their vehicle. So I don't want to diminish that stat, but at the same time, use of force incidents don't happen on calls that don't have enforcement action. So I think arrests is maybe a better metric for that. And I did pull that data, and I can share that with you as well, Jamie. I pulled our arrest data for 2019, 2020, and 2021. And during that, the full years of 2019 and 2020, and then partial for 2021, we've made 4,295 arrests. So when we look at the 51,500 incidents that the data that Captain Winterscheidt provided, of that 51,500, approximately 4,300 of them were arrest situations. And then when we look at our use of force data, 48 incidents that involved the use of force, when we compare that to the approximately 4,300 arrests during that period, then we come up with a percentage of about 1% of our arrests result in some application of use of force.
Right. The point I was making, which was in the favor of the department, is that most likely when you're talking about 51,000 and then you drill that down and you get 48 incidents, you know, that means most likely you're not going to have a use of force situation. That being said, I'll have one criticism on it. Captain Winterschmidt's report uses the word suspects, and I'm wondering, is that really, you know, I hope that all 51,500 people aren't considered suspects, right? Some of us are just driving our cars and using the wrong turn signal or something.
Right, and I agree completely with that. One of those incidents, for example, was likely a traffic stop where maybe we just stopped a vehicle and issued a warning, and the car could have three people in it. So that one incident out of the 51,500, you know, many incidents obviously have contact with multiple people, and in most cases they aren't suspects. I think if we were to apply the label suspect, the most appropriate number to incorporate that too would be our arrest data, which is 4,295, simply because when somebody is arrested, they are suspected of committing a crime.
You know, speaking of suspects, I think like some data that we're going to be really excited to see would be that arrest data, and possibly stratified by race as well. Because while the use of force incidents are really interesting to look at on their own and try to figure out how to diminish them overall, I think that disproportionality when it comes to race in that data can also be either supported or not supported through looking at other data as well, including arrest. In the meantime, though, because it is hard to get that massive amount of data, I did go ahead this morning look at the Douglas County Jail. So as of 7:30 a.m. this morning, so I guess this is Wednesday, February 24th,
we're recording it on Wednesday, yes, right.
Oh, yeah. So 12% of the inmates at the jail were Native, 16% of the inmates were Black, and 72% were white. And that's compared to in Douglas County, where only 1.3% of the residents are Black and 2% are Native. And I think while I understand that that data has a lot of flaws, including, you know, the sheriff departments, U.S. Marshals, they're also making arrests outside of the city of Superior. I also think it is a great way to, or at least a start when trying to figure out how the department and how departments in Douglas County are addressing racial disproportionality when it comes to their practices. And kind of like Robin was alluding to, I think, you know, even though the use of force incident is like the most extreme, probably most traumatic in the moment experience for some of these individuals, I think that what we all know is that having a criminal record, being sent to jail, going to prison, having a felony or a misdemeanor, also has just extreme outcomes on the rest of people's lives when it comes to getting jobs and when it comes to getting houses or cars or loans or anything like that. So I think I'd be really excited to get that arrest data.
I agree. I think that would be a great set of data to look at. It's obviously a little bit more comprehensive than just use of force because, you know, use of force incidents are only about 1% of total arrests. So when we look at the total arrest data by demographic and other considerations, I do think that that does likely paint a better picture. I do appreciate you noting, you know, that the Douglas County Jail houses inmates from not only other counties but other states and multiple agencies. So I don't know if that data, you know, it paints a good picture of the arrests for Superior PD, but when we pull our arrest data and break it down, that definitely will help. We did recently do that on our traffic stops. We did a breakdown based by race, and we did find some disparities there. I don't have the document directly in front of me, but it certainly wasn't. It didn't match the census estimate demographics. It wasn't grossly misproportionated, but there definitely were some disparities there. So that is something that we are looking into in our Commission of Communities of Color. We've been working with them on that project. I'm going to just try to pull that out here real quick.
And as you're pulling that out, I will remind everyone we're speaking with Jamie Sharp of the Law Enforcement Accountability Network, or LEAN, and Chief Nicholas Alexander of the Superior Police Department. Let me throw it to Jamie for a second here on a broad question, and we can come back to this. Jamie, is this whole project something of a self-fulfilling prophecy? So, like, did you expect the data to show a disparity? Even in my introduction, right, I pointed out this is, you know, a huge topic across the country. You know, what were you expecting, and, you know, what's your reaction to what you got?
Yeah, that's a great question, Robin. I mean, I can kind of speak to the personal nature of this project for me. I work in healthcare, and I work as an EMT in particular. I previously worked at the St. Louis County Jail within their healthcare department, and I currently work in an ambulance. So I am constantly working with law enforcement on the front line. What I kind of just started to see on my own experiences was kind of, we live in the Northland, which is a very white place, you know. In Douglas County, 92.6% white. And all of a sudden in my job, especially when I was working with law enforcement, I just kept seeing more and more people of color, especially on those calls that were included in law enforcement and especially while I was working in the jail. So that's what led me to run the data in the first place. So I guess I kind of was expecting to see a disproportionality. But to be honest with you, I was not expecting to find how disproportionate the data was. And to be honest, you know, LEAN being a data group, we aren't necessarily the ones who are creating the reform proposals, and we aren't the ones who are like the activist organizations pushing for the change. We're really more in the numbers and trying to, I guess, kind of get a non-biased resource for people, whether it's in the police department or in the community, to then reference when creating the change that they want to see. You know, and on our website, it's made pretty clear on our data page that, you know, we're more interested in getting it right as opposed to necessarily portraying a certain view. And that's why we include all of the raw data that we get from the department available for download on the website.
Great. And you've given Nick a chance to find it. So have you uncovered it?
I have. So we had recently looked at our traffic stops. I believe it was 2019 was the set of data that we pulled. We had 3,142 traffic tickets, and of those, 88.6% were issued to Caucasian drivers, 5.9% to African American, and 3.1% to American Indian or First Nation persons. So again, they're you know, looking at some of the demographic data that, you know, Jamie mentioned, the 5.9 is about three times higher than the, you know, than the census estimate data, and 3.1 for the American Indian category is about 1.5 times higher. The one thing that we did look at on that data too was, if we're going to compare a traffic ticket to our resident population, then, you know, I think a reasonable question to ask is how many of the tickets were to residents, because that's the base that we're using for the demographic. And in that case, with the African Americans who were issued tickets, a total of 184 to 3142 were, but about half of those were non-residents of the city of Superior.
Well, I want to take the rare opportunity to be maybe a little inappropriately flippant, but of course most of the crime is committed by people coming from elsewhere, right? No one in Superior does anything bad. We know that, right?
No, I don't think that's the case.
One thing I want to add too is I'm curious if you ran the data to see what percentage of the white people who received those traffic tickets and stops were from not from Superior as well. I think one thing that some listeners might think when hearing that kind of explanation for that data discrepancy is really a kind of classic trope that black people are coming in from out of town and performing crimes. I know in Duluth, like I live on the Central Hillside, and you know, a lot of people, when I tell them I live here, say, oh, like that's where all the people from Chicago live.
Right.
Because there are plenty of white tourists who I'm sure are coming into town and
committing crimes. I agree with you 100%, and I think probably the largest category that we would see is that, you know, the residents of Duluth.
Right. You both managed to throw...
I've never committed a crime in Superior.
I think these discussions are important, and I hope none of that came across as trying to make excuses. I'm pointing out that, you know, there's another category where we see some disparity, and we can't do anything to correct disparities or to look at policies or practices to see if they contribute to it if we don't have these discussions.
Jamie, your hope for the future, what do you want to see?
What I'm really interested to hear about is really why do you think there is a racial disparity when it comes to traffic stops, the population at the Douglas County Jail, and the use of force incidents? You know, do you think that lies behind policing culture? Do you think that lies behind specific racist police officers within the department? And I'm very interested in hearing, you know, what you're going to be doing to change this in the future, because at the end of the day, I think what my goal is to run the data that we're talking about right now in 5 years and have it be proportionate to the population. I guess like that's my biggest question.
Sure. Last word, Chief.
I don't have an easy answer for that. What I do believe is that poverty is probably the greatest contribution to most of these problems, in the sense that minority groups are incredibly overrepresented in terms of poverty. And there's decades of data to show that there are more arrests and more crimes in neighborhoods of poverty and low income. So I think that that's probably one of the larger contributing factors to it. Certainly there can be police culture and policy issues that have contributed to it as well. But I think that we need to look a little bit, you know, further into the data before I were to draw any conclusions there. Jamie mentioned how a criminal record can have such a devastating effect on a person's life, and I thought that was a very profound statement. You know, I've been looking at ways within our department to try to reduce people's exposure to the criminal justice system. One is our Pathways to Hope program, where on every adult arrest that we make now, we go through a checklist, and if we determine that the underlying cause of their arrest is addiction, we give them an opportunity at that point to get them near immediate access to a treatment program in lieu of arrest. And if they don't have the financial resources to do it, we pay for it.
All right. Well, on that note, we've been speaking with Jamie Sharp from the Grassroots Data Crunching Group, Law Enforcement Accountability Network, and Chief Nick Alexander of the Superior Police Department. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Great Lakes Country with Breanne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners.
My heart is racing and starting to sweat. Wrapped up together, I'm out of breath. Are you ready for what happens next?
The fiddle in this catchy rockabilly song is so bluegrass you can almost see the chickens scurrying around. But it's not about hog farms or bales of hay on pickup trucks. Rather, it's about the central hillside of Duluth.
On a warm summer day in Central Hillside.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The music genre we're sharing today is Great Lakes Country, and it originates from a front porch in Duluth. That's where you'll find Breanne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners, who include a couple of Wisconsinites helping out. Breanne Tepler was well known in Duluth business and higher education circles when she broke out in a singing career in 2013, a calling in response to personal tragedy. She translated that to song, and it's okay to call it therapy, and got a group to back her. They've just released what is, for her third album. There's an asterisk on that, and I'll let her explain. And Breanne joins me now to explain and share it with us. Welcome to Simply Superior, Breanne.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And you want to explain that asterisk?
Absolutely. So this project is our first full band produced album. In the prior works that I've done, they've been under Breanne Marie. But with the efforts of everyone in the band on this particular project, there's no way I could just put my name on it. It was a full band effort.
All right. Well, and I'm going to ask you more about the band and the band's name in a bit. But first, let's go back in history a little bit. We've known each other for quite a while. You once upon a time were Breanne Defoe at the Duluth Area Chamber of Commerce. I think membership director, whatever it was, you knew everybody in town, right?
Well, you know, David Ross always said working at the Chamber in Duluth was one of the biggest stages in Minnesota. And yeah, I was a director for Fuse Duluth and membership. And shortly after my time there, I got divorced, I remarried, and went into higher education. And I've been at the College of St. Scholastica since.
Right. And then the other personal tragedies that I alluded to, you lost your brother in a car accident, your father took his own life, and you had other, frankly, more than anybody should, tragic experiences of people close to you. So would we even recognize the Breanne that we knew back then?
You would not. I've been through so many situations and life experiences that have really evolved who I am as a person. You mentioned that it's okay to say that my music is therapy, because it is. In 2018, my other brother, Justin, died in an ATV accident. So now I've suffered three immediate family member losses since 2006. And just digging deeper each time into the music and songwriting and really not taking life for granted. These types of losses shape how a person does all aspects of their lives, how they are as a parent or a wife or an employee or a musician. All of it is impacted.
Mm-hmm. And you're not the first person, of course, to unveil yourself in music. Joni Mitchell is very famous for it. Have you ever felt that you've been too revealing?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that with social media, we are, as a society, we are more apt to share than we ever have before. But each time that I share something about losses or mental health, there's a moment where I have to make that decision. Is this too much? Does this need to be shared? And I go by that process of, is it helpful? Is it kind? Is it truthful? And I got to tell you, most often when I share something, I get a response via private message from someone that says, thank you for sharing that. That really helped me today. Or thank you for sharing your story. Can you help me find resources for me and my daughter? So I think that sharing, there's a balance there that you have to be careful with, but I always have an answer to why. But why am I sharing this?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that. I'm actually trying to cut back on social media. I don't think everybody needs to know what I had for breakfast or my opinion on your breakfast. But that said, there are, just today, a friend of mine said, I am all clear. There's no cancer, and it's heartwarming. As you said, the way you express something may help bring some solace to somebody. We're speaking with Breanne Tepler of Breanne Marie and the Front Page Center. Front Page. I'm still in the newspaper, right? And the Front Porch Centers. Along the lines of personal, let's hear Too Tired to Cry off your new album, Juniper. Set that up for us.
Yeah, Too Tired to Cry is a song about grief. I found a connection between in northern Minnesota and Wisconsin here where the weather is too cold to snow, and that connection we have between when we're just too exhausted to muster up some tears to cry.
That is a wonderful analogy, especially since we just went through the sub-zero temperatures, and thankfully it was too cold to snow. Here is Too Tired to Cry by Breanne Marie and the Front Porch Centers.
Chasing ghosts again this week, looking for you in my sleep. Went to all the places we would go, like that pawn shop downtown, the one with all the old guitars, and the park on Masaba Avenue. So weak, standing here unable to speak. If you had given us a little more time, one more trip around the sun, another year of memories made.
And that was Too Tired to Cry off the new album Juniper by Breanne Marie and the Front Porch Centers. And that was Masaba Avenue you were singing about. Tell us about the band's name and the people in it. And as I alluded to earlier, a few are from the Wisconsin side. Am I correct?
You are correct. The band name, Front Porch Sinners, comes from me thinking about my preteen and teenage days on a front porch in Central Hillside, where we may have been, I don't know, saying some swear words and some things that other folks might say we were sinning or having some sin. And, you know, it's also one of those country style names. So you've got Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two, or, you know, these classic Opry, Grand Ole Opry days of artists where you have the lead and the something. Well, for me, that's Front Porch Sinners. And I'll tell you who they are. We've got Evan Tepler on guitar, and we've got Matt Groom on drums, Kaylin Spencer on fiddle, Johnny Blaze Peterson on pedal steel, Kyle Gondick Anderson on bass, and Danielle Gondick Anderson on harmony vocals. We're just a fun group. We have classic country instruments, but set to the types of things that people in these Great Lakes Rust Belt communities go through, these hard times that we go through.
So did you coin the phrase Great Lakes Country, or did you pick that up somewhere? Is there a whole section at Electric Fetus I don't know about?
I coined that term. I hope it catches on. I'd love to find a whole Great Lakes Country community out there. So if you're listening right now and you feel like you play Great Lakes Country, please reach out to me on our social media and let's get a group going so we can pass along these ideas and these sounds. I think it is a unique sound that we have, but it pulls on traditional classic country with our fiddle, our pedal steel, the upright bass. When you put those sounds together, you're having a very much classical feel to it. But it certainly, the stuff that we're singing about really speaks to today and what these generations are going through in these Rust Belt communities.
Mm-hmm. And you alluded to social media, so tell us how we find you in URL, webpage.
Our webpage is briannemarie.com. That's briannemarie.com. And all of our social media is linked to that website.
All right. And tell us about the title track of your new album, Juniper.
The title of the album and the title track have two different Juniper meanings. So the Juniper title of the album stands for a juniper tree, which is a very rugged tree with deep roots that can withstand a lot of harsh elements. The place that I first found a juniper tree was in the Colorado Rockies, outside of Denver, Colorado, when I was at Red Rocks Amphitheater. And that's what the album is named after, and the pacing of the album feels like a long hike in the Rocky Mountains. Now, the Juniper title track, or the song, that was written in quarantine. So it was actually written after the whole album was done being written. It was an added song. And I wrote it about a young woman named Juniper, someone that I imagine who is going through trying to navigate love and relationships. So it's a song about lust and love, which is a subject that I don't often write about, but it turned out fantastic with all of the instrumentation that the band put into it, and just has a very unique vibe or mood, as the kids say these days.
All right. Well, let's hear that mood. Here's Juniper by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. Thank you. That was Juniper by Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners. I am speaking with Brianne Marie Tepler, and Juniper is also the title of their new album. With all the adversity you've experienced, I'm almost scared to ask you this, but tell me about Dead Man Walking, another song on the album. Unless you just borrowed the name from the movie, there's got to be a story behind it.
Dead Man Walking is our one song on the album that I did not write. This song was written by Kirk Jenness. Kirk is the lead singer and songwriter for the Iron Range Outlaw Brigade, which is a bunch of rowdy boys from up north in the Iron Range of Minnesota. And we share a pedal steel player with the Iron Range Outlaw Brigade and ourselves. So Johnny Blaze is in both bands. And we are probably the biggest fans of IROB, that's Iron Range Outlaw Brigade for short. And we knew that we would want to cover IROB songs, and this we've been doing this for a few years. But when we first played Dead Man Walkin', there was so much swagger in that song that every bandmate, every Front Porch Sinner played to the personality of this dead man walking around. And so we have a ton of fun with that song. I think it really comes through on the track. And for fun, we added two trumpets instead of one to give it that spaghetti western feel. And this is the first song I've ever recorded my trumpet on. And then my friend Matt Livefree joined me with his trumpet parts. So it's a fun tune.
All right, well, we're going to let it swagger us out of here. We've been speaking with Brianne Marie Tepler of Brianne Marie and Front Porch Sinners. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, the wolf hunt has come and very quickly gone. I think it's safe to say the proponents and opponents spent more time arguing about it than it took to hold it. How did it all shape out?
Yeah, well, basically in the course of just a couple of days, hunters far exceeded the state's quota set by wildlife officials, and that brought an early end to the season on Wednesday. It's the state's first wolf hunt in 6 years. You know, in previous hunts that were held before the animal was placed back on the endangered species list, they also exceeded quotas, but this hunt where there was a quota of about 200 wolves, state licensed hunters ended up harvesting 213 wolves, and that's as of 8 a.m. Thursday. So that's well above the 119 wolves that the state allocated for state licensed hunters. You know, they had to split that quota with the state's Ojibwe tribes as part of their federal treaty rights. But it's usually the tribes have decided not to use any of the permits that have been issued them because Mayangan, or the Anishinaabe word for wolf, you know, they consider it a close relative. And so, you know, tribes and animal rights and environmental groups have been really upset with this rush to hold a wolf hunt. They say it was not at all based on science. They point to a wolf management plan that is woefully out of date. But hunters, you know, they've been afraid that this may be their only opportunity to hold a hunt because the Biden administration is reviewing the wolf delisting after the Trump administration made a decision to delist the wolf last month. And so, you know, even though this season is just ending, already hunters can apply for wolf permits again for the hunt in November. And that kicks off a whole nother process of what we're going to see with the next wolf hunt here in Wisconsin.
Well, as passionate as people are on both sides of that issue, you had another story this week that should be startling to anyone who dials 911 in certain towns in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah. So, you know, there are several towns in northern Wisconsin in Ashland County. And right now, if a resident was to call 911, there's no guarantee that anyone would answer. And the reason for that is they lost their ambulance service at the beginning of this year. Great Divide Ambulance Service out of Cable notified six towns last summer that they'd be ending five-year contracts with them. So now the towns of Gordon, Shenandoah, and Marengo haven't been able to find another provider or get their own service up and running. And this just kind of highlights the problems that rural emergency medical service providers are facing in Wisconsin. You know, part of the reason for that is because they can't find enough people or enough volunteers to run this service. You know, around 92% of Wisconsin fire departments are staffed by volunteers. More than half of emergency medical service providers are staffed by volunteers. So this puts a lot of pressure on those communities surrounding those three towns that do have an ambulance service provider. And so that left these three towns basically in the middle of the woods with no help in some circumstances. And so now there are some legislative solutions that are being pursued by Republican lawmakers. But Democrats in the legislature say, you know, these proposals don't go far enough. We need more funding. We need to pay people to do this work. We need to do something more to try to provide the service in rural areas.
And that could be quite scary. Brooks, on the Minnesota side, there was also a scary incident attached to an issue as contentious as the wolf hunt, the pipeline.
Yes, so last Friday, an area of the Fond du Lac Reservation near Cloquet, about a half-mile radius area, was evacuated after a bomb scare, essentially. Authorities were investigating a suspicious package that was thrown Friday afternoon as protesters were dispersing. There was no bomb, and it ended up people could come back to the area after just a few hours, but you know, emergency alerts went out on phones. It's prompted a strong response from the Fond du Lac band, which put out a news release last week saying, you know, for outside protesters instigating violence and violating band law, Chairman Kevin Dupas said, leave now, you are not welcome here. Protesters who are band members are standing their ground, and they are continuing to fight against the Line 3 pipeline Enbridge is currently building across Minnesota. But it does go to show that there remain divisions, you know, among bands and leadership, those protesting the pipeline and those who want to see it finished. The Fond du Lac band has an agreement with Enbridge that allows 13 miles of its pipeline to cross its territory, and the reservation business committee has been clear that that sovereign decision should be respected.
Right. Well, on a lighter note, I think, although it goes counter to our stay off the Big Lake ice warning that we had last week from two scientists, there's ice racing going on off the shore of Wisconsin.
Yes. So my colleague Katie Galliato and photographer Alex Corman got out on the ice on Alouise Bay last weekend to spend the afternoon watching people drive around, racing at 65 miles an hour, top speeds. And back then, you know, it was a little icier, a little more safer ice, I'd say, after this warm streak where we're not having great ice on the lake, but on the bay. It was pretty thrilling. And we'll have a story this weekend you can read about detailing the exploits of the Lake Superior Ice Racing Association.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau, including Katie Galliato and her ice racing report, at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Brianne Marie and the Front Porch Sinners, Turning Stones. Stay safe, everyone.
I went down.
shoreline to watch the sun rise.